Utilities are not denying climate change. They're looking at the world and saying, okay, the entire world's going to low carbon. Am I really going to bet on a political strategy that's a 2 or 4 year window at best?
Looking back, 1917 was a pretty important year in human history. It was the year the United States took up arms in World War I, as well as the year the Russian Tsar was overthrown, bringing the Bolsheviks to power. But perhaps the most consequential development of 1917 was fairly unheralded at the time. The birth of a person who would serve as a source of strength and inspiration to countless Americans. Naturally, I'm referring to one of PolicyCast's most avid listeners, my grandmother, Mary Kerr Lynch. Love you, Nan. But I suppose it could also apply to another native of Brookline, Massachusetts, President John F. Kennedy. And while I look forward to celebrating my grandma's 100th birthday this July, President Kennedy's premature demise ensures that the otherwise joyous marking of his centennial in just a few days also carries with it a sense of loss for what might have been. In place of the unrealized ambitions of JFK's short time in office, remains a legacy perhaps even more potent than any single policy achievement, and one borne out by the mission of this very institution, a commitment to meet the challenges of our time through public service. Hello and welcome to the Harvard Kennedy School PolicyCast. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader, and today's guest is no stranger to that commitment. A career public servant in both Democratic and Republican administrations, Gina McCarthy most recently served as administrator of the EPA in the Obama administration, where she took on perhaps the biggest challenge of our time, global climate change. She's on campus this spring as an Institute of Politics fellow.
Gina, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here, Matt. Thanks for inviting me.
So in your tenure as administrator of the EPA, one of the plans that was developed was the Clean Power Plan. Can you talk about that? What is that and how exactly does it work?
Well, I was with the Obama administration for 8 years, so we did a lot of great work on clean air and clean water. But as you and I think know, climate change is real. It's happening. We have to take action. And it happened to be a specific focus of attention for both myself and the president in his second term. And one of the things he did was to lay out basically a climate action plan, which had a bunch of strong domestic actions that he wanted to ensure were taken in hopes that that would change the international discussion and lead to what inevitably did lead to in Paris, which is a strong, accountable international agreement. And then thirdly, he wanted to make sure we did more on adaptation, recognizing that the climate has changed. Cities and towns are going to be facing significant challenges. We wanted to support them in becoming more resilient to a changing climate. Now, the Clean Power Plan in particular was really, I think, most notable because it was the biggest signal that the United States could take to tell the international community that we were serious about climate change, that it wasn't the same old anymore. And so we worked very hard on it. It was something that I started even before becoming EPA administrator. When I was assistant administrator in the air program, we pulled informal meetings together with utilities, advocates, individual citizens, to talk about what we do with utilities. They're the largest stationary source of greenhouse gas emissions. At that point, they were. Now we're being bypassed by transportation in the U.S.
Well, I think most people, when they think of global warming,
that's what they think.
They think of
cars.
They
see that, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, really?
Well,
really?
I would say in terms of emissions, the cost of gas.
Yeah.
What is the percentages, I guess? I don't know if you know this off the top of your head.
Well, I do. Yeah. In the stationary side, utilities are far and away the largest. They're like two-thirds of that. But transportation now has gotten a bigger piece of the pie. So they have just recently eclipsed the energy sector in terms of larger greenhouse gas emissions, just barely.
And they
are projected to increase where the utility world is projected to go down, which is why the Clean Power Plan was so very timely, Matt. Because we've been talking about taking steps like this. But in the United States, President Obama, during the first term, spent a lot of the recovery money, remember, big billions of dollars, looking at how we invest in clean energy. And as a result of that and other really great innovations here and elsewhere, renewable energy has become much less expensive than it used to. So when we were looking at the Clean Power Plan, we were already looking at an energy market that was being transformed. Mm-hmm. An energy market with low natural gas prices, where coal was uncompetitive in most parts of the country, remains uncompetitive, but also one in which, because of the decrease in the price of renewables, and it, I mean, we're not talking about little decreases. We're talking about wind from 2009 to 2015 going down 61% in their costs. Solar, 81%. These are incredible innovations being brought to the table. And now they are beating out even inexpensive natural gas in parts of the country. So we were seeing that it was the fiscally responsible decision to start transforming the energy market to make renewables and efficiency programs much bigger piece of the pie. It's happening anyways. So the Clean Power Plan basically regulated the amount, created a standard for the amount of carbon that could be emitted by utilities on a state-by-state basis. And then it left the flexibility up to states on how they would do it. They want to do it within their own borders and meet those standards? Do they want to use regional markets? Do they want to even expand more and participate in a national program? And when you did that, you saw how inexpensive and easy it would do to actually make significant reductions moving forward if you used a flexible approach like this.
Mm-hmm.
So while the Clean Power Plan was a terrific step forward domestically, it also had that kind of trigger that we were hoping for in international discussions. And it allowed President Obama to talk with President Xi, to talk with folks in India and elsewhere about how we go into the Paris discussion with a really much more well-framed agreement so that we weren't floundering to get everybody there. It was more like we were just trying to round up the sheep so that we could all flock in the right direction. Mm-hmm. And it worked wonderfully well because I think the rest of the world realizes that if the two biggest polluters and the two biggest emitters, China and the U.S., are standing hand in hand saying they're going to be accountable. Everybody else has to, too.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna adjust this over time as science demands. We're all going to get there. And they saw that there were real opportunities with technology development to get there in a way that was fiscally responsible,
mm-hmm.
that we could just underpin that momentum. And we could make that real for everybody. And that's really what Paris brought to the table, and it provided stability to the business community. The Clean Power Plan provided a window all the way out to 2030 so utilities would know how they should be investing to have the kind of diverse portfolio they'd need.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only gotten better over time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Clean Power Plan is stuck in the courts a little bit, and we certainly have heard that this administration isn't supportive of it. But the courts and the administration are not going to change the direction of the clean energy market in the United States. That train's left the station. It's chugging along, and it ain't coming back. And the brilliant thing about it is that we're now talking about – sorry, I don't mean to sound – it's not the brilliance of about the plan, but the brilliance of the energy transition. I didn't want to sound like I was really patting myself on the back.
You may deserve it in this particular case. So.
Well, you know, we did work really hard with the utilities to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
Because if they're heading in the right direction and all I want to do is make sure that I keep pushing that, it's an entirely different conversation than saying I'd like you to turn around and try another direction.
So how does that work when you're working with utilities who
yeah.
why would they want I can imagine they were you know, super open to more regulation. you know. But you're saying this beneficial for them.
You know what it is, Matt, and I don't think people recognize that is the utility industry spends billions and billions of dollars every year on infrastructure, on capital expenses. And what they really realized is, number one, utilities are not denying climate change. They're looking at the world and saying, okay, the entire world's going to low carbon. Am I really going to bet on a political strategy that's a 2 or 4 year window at best and invest all my money in trying to beef up 50 or 60-year-old pieces of equipment so I can keep doing that endlessly? Or am I going to look at a real investment strategy that big businesses do? Mm-hmm. And that's what they wanted. They wanted the stability moving out for a lengthy period of time so that they could invest wisely, get rid of and retire old, outdated equipment, and really be able to have investment, real investment, not just plugging holes and making the pipes a little bit better, but real investment in an energy system that they could rely on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And utilities have not been making those types of investments for years. Mm-hmm. And so they all finally figured out that this is the time for us to really revise our thinking, to think more progressively about where we're trying to head in a future that is really going to be carbon constrained. And the great thing about it is that they knew they had a market for this. It wasn't going to strain because buying renewables and efficiency is fiscally responsible. Mm-hmm. And the last piece is we have like 2.5 million people working in clean energy in this country. The solar industry this year thinks they're going to also increase another 15% in terms of job growth. We're talking about over a 1.9 million in energy efficiency programs. I mean, these are the jobs of the future. So for this administration to think that by signing an executive order that says I want to rethink a rule, that the record of that rule is going to be robust, that it's going to be scientifically credible and legally defensible, I don't think so.
Well, of course, the Obama administration had tremendous difficulty getting legislation passed, certainly on this issue with a Republican controlled Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You were able to make progress despite that. Obviously, now we are in a different world. Your successor, you probably were most familiar with from a courtroom.
It's my only familiarity. Not the best place to make a friend, I don't think.
Scott Pruitt had sued the EPA many times.
14
times.
Not that I know these things off the top of my head.
As Oklahoma Attorney General. When you're developing rules like this, in a democracy, you have to assume some change will happen, perhaps not to this degree.
Yeah.
But how do you think about it? Does it change the way you develop rules? Do you try to seek policies that are harder to reverse, either politically, legally, bureaucratically, to ensure progress continues, especially on long-term issues like global warming?
Well, here's what you try to do when you're doing a rule, and especially the Clean Power Plan we did extraordinary outreach on. We received more than 4 million comments on this thing. And when lawyers are hired to give comments on a proposal, they give you all of their legal strategies. They start poking at it and poking at it. Mm-hmm. And so it gives you a good idea of what they might be thinking about later in a courtroom to start challenging things. But more importantly, it got a lot of people engaged. And it got the utilities to at the table in a very serious way. And I'm a person with a reputation for seeking out the disagreements and for trying to resolve them. I made huge differences between the proposal and the final because we listened. And we made changes. And in the end, if the utilities were able to get out of the political context in which they live, I think they'd tell you we did a great job at it. Because most of the states are already at levels that we were not even asking them to be at until 2022. So even the states that sued us are making this work, even without the rule being implemented. So all of them have run to court saying, this is impossible, we can't do it, when these states, a lot of them are already at where we wanted them in 2022.
Can you talk about some of the examples of when the utility, when you were able to go back and change specifics about the plan because of the utility pushback?
Oh, sure. Many. We took a look at the opportunities on site to make changes, and they identified both technologies that they thought would be helpful and technology limitations that would limit the ability to get those reductions that we were anticipating. We got comments that we shouldn't limit ourselves to just specific regions for trading programs, mm-hmm. that we should think about an opportunity for looking at where the interconnects are and use a lot bigger system and factor how well we could integrate those into the system. We were told that we shouldn't rely on energy efficiency as a part of the standard setting process, but instead give credit for it as a way to achieve the standard. We made that change and it was pretty dramatic. So there were many, many things that they lined up. But honestly, Matt, if you've got really good information, I'm changing it. Because that's what the law requires. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require us to sit and think big thoughts to ourselves about what we want the standard to be. It was looking at the technology opportunities to get there. That is my obligation. Mm-hmm. And if a utility works with you well, they'll give you the information you need to make it actually hold from a legal standpoint, from a technical standpoint, and allow you to make those moderate adjustments over time so that you're not threatening reliability, you're not increasing cost to consumers. Mm-hmm. These things are important to consider if you want to do a long-term strategy and have the American public behind you. And I think we frankly do. It's just become very political to deal with the issue of climate change. And there's lots of reasons for that we could talk about endlessly. But on its face, it's a good rule. It's got a great solid record that's legally correct, that's scientifically correct, based on real data. And it's going to hold. And I don't think this administration can change that record by simply deciding I'd rather not agree with the science. It's just not a great legal argument, especially since the Supreme Court has weighed in on the science two or three times.
Compromise is often seen as a zero-sum game. Yeah. You're giving up something if you want to get something. Did you find more often than not that was the case, where you were, watering down the end result in terms of the effect on the climate in order to appease the constituency, the industry?
You know, the way we would generally look at this, Matt, and I'm not trying to avoid the question, but many of the rules under the Clean Air Act, it really isn't a negotiation. It's getting the data correct, mm-hmm. because it tells us how we do our work. It says you have to be cost effective when you're dealing with technologies for existing facilities. That's not a negotiation point. I have to have it. And so we had to look at making sure we had the technical information to base a standard on. But what where negotiation does come in is, you know, facts are one thing, policy's great, but the judgment that I need to layer on it, it's what's reasonable to expect to be done within a certain period of time that isn't going to tax the system of delivering reliable and effective energy. So we had to work with the energy regulators to say, what do you need to build this into your system? How much time would it take for the utility world to actually be able to ramp up, to be able to achieve a standard? That's why one of the things we changed between proposal and final was when we'd actually expect the first standard to kick in. That kicked out to 2022, mm-hmm. which to a normal person would seem like, wow, that's a long time. But we are talking about big investment decisions, big technology decisions. And there's no way when you're a smart regulator, and I hope I'm in that somewhat large category, you know, you want to make it reasonable and you want to keep driving down, but not in a way that's going to threaten what is also a big public health issue, which is I need energy. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to trade that off. So we pushed out the timeline. We made the reductions you need over time to be more modest. But in the end, we ended up with more reductions than we would have otherwise. Mm-hmm. So to me, I'm not giving up on the public health mission of the agency, but I am doing everything I can to make it reasonable and appropriate for the regulated entity, for the consumers that need to work with them. Because mm-hmm. I am not going to give in the short, I'm not going to expect unreasonable things in the short term, because that means you'll never get to those long-term reductions that in the end will be better if you act more reasonably.
Mm-hmm. You've cited data and the science several times now. Yeah. Up until, I guess, fairly recently, the biggest problem for climate change has been getting, in the United States, people to acknowledge that it exists.
It's hard to tell them to beat something up if you haven't met them yet. That's right.
But this was despite the fact that the much bandied number 97% of scientists believe that the climate is warming and that it's human caused. Now that's starting to change a little bit. There's still an undercurrent of denial out there, but now it's shifted into a question of, well, okay, what do we do about this? If it took this long and this much effort to just get people to acknowledge something with that kind of certainty behind it, what's the next step when you have perhaps a solution which 70% of scientists agree with, or something along that line?
You know, climate has been, I think, one of the most difficult challenges. I've been doing this work all across the environmental spectrum for, I don't know, 36, 37 years. I know I don't look it. Those
not at all.
People listening may not know how youthful I look, but so I should point that out. But it's very challenging because climate change was both something which we were trying to get people to invest heavily to prevent something in the future that we were predicting. That's where we were 20 or 30 years ago. And it was also way past political windows. So who wants to really push this as a politician? And it became so heavily relied on science, which to most people, they don't understand. If you tell them it's going to be 1 degree warmer next year, everybody would go, yay, more sun, lots of beach time. You know, they don't understand the implications of it. And that's not criticizing people. It's just you don't learn this in school. And so it took a long time for us to get where we are today. And where we are today, recent polls, you know, certainly at Yale has shown us that about 70% of the people not only understand that the climate has changed, but they understand that they want to have leadership and action in the U.S. on climate, including actions like the Clean Power Plan. And we've seen recent polling that people are really fully behind clean air and clean water at EPA. As long as they recognize that that's what's at threat in climate, we should be all set. I feel like we've crossed that hump. Now, I realize you're going to hear still a lot about climate denial and relooking at the science. That's a pretty well-funded campaign, and that's not going to go away for a while. But normal people know that the climate's changed. That's the unfortunate thing, Matt, is we've lost years of opportunity to prevent the kind of impacts we're already seeing. But people are feeling it. You know, President Obama said...
Former president.
Yeah, former president. I know. I'm sorry. I have trouble with that. I don't know if it's conscious or unconscious. But he basically said this is the first generation to feel the impacts of climate and the last to do something about it. And he's right. People are connecting the dots. You know, one of the reasons I'm here, Matt, is to talk to the science folks about some of this stuff, because I think how they articulate science to the public makes it very hard for the public to understand. And that's been part of the challenge. You know, the way I've seen the climate science is that you see all these different lines of evidence happening that scientists connect in their head. But then when you have a wildfire that's extreme, when you have a number of droughts, they say, well, that could be weather, so you can't count any individual event. Well, you kind of cut the legs off of individuals like me who are trying to explain to people that these are really big things, and aren't they weird? They'll say they're really big things and they're weird, but they wouldn't say they were climate change because we couldn't connect those dots.
But of course, then you'll have the senator going out with the snowball.
Exactly. Senator Inhofe throwing the snowball on the Senate floor. It's really interesting because, you know, he thinks it's all global warming. So if there's snow, it apparently isn't the case. Instead of understanding it's the intensity of the storms that we worry about. But then scientists would say, well, it's very likely. You know, say very likely to a normal human being. They go, huh? What? You mean you don't know? Aren't scientists trying to get the right answer and stand behind it? And then they'd say things like, but the science is evolving. So, you know, when a normal person hears, that's the biggest hedge anyone could ever say. Because maybe next week they'll say that we should heavily invest in fossil, right? And so the way that scientists talk is they're not leading with the things they know. They always want to spend a lot of time on the limitations and the uncertainties. People
but
don't.
That is based. I mean, there is a lot of uncertainty about the specific, like the details.
There's very much. There are limitations to what science can tell you, and when. But if you ask them if the earth is flat or round, they'd give you similar limitations. People don't know how to make a judgment about where this lands in the spectrum because they actually don't know scientists work on probabilities. You do. Mm-hmm. I do. The general public doesn't. So all I'm asking them to do is to be sensitive to their audience and to figure out how not to be inaccurate, but to be much clearer about what they know. And what do they think as an individual on the basis of what science is telling them? Because if you allow us to connect the dots more readily, the picture is crystal clear. And that's really what science does for us, mm-hmm. is it paints a picture that otherwise individuals wouldn't know. And I think we all feel pretty comfortable about the certainty we need to be able to protect our planet. Because it's not just about how certain we are, but the risk of not acting. And those two things combined together demand the kind of actions that we've been taking and more. And the most exciting part is, and really for me, is if we can get the momentum to continue with individuals across the country, they will speak to the leadership. We will continue to get movement forward. And when once it's built into a market like the energy system is right now, mm-hmm. it just will continue to roll forward. But what regulation does for you, and other things can do it as well, if there's laws that can get passed, it just says what your core value is. You know, it reflects what you want the future to look like, and it sends a signal to innovators and entrepreneurs that it's worth their investment in a long-term strategy to get the next tranche of technology solutions that we're going to need. Because while I'm confident that the United States can meet our 2025 goal of 26% below 2005 levels, mm-hmm. I'm confident we can do that on the basis of technologies available. I do not know how to get to further reductions without continuing to rely on the innovation in the United States. Mm-hmm. That's what you could harm by losing a few years, is I want everyone to say what they want the future to look like so that we can send the business community, individual communities across the country, our cities, our towns, states, the right signals about where they should be investing in the innovations that we're looking for.
Well, judging by the hundreds of thousands of people who turned out for the Science March, I think their vision of the future is very much rooted in mm-hmm. science and technology.
I think it was wonderful. More people turned out than anyone would expect. Part of my cold is as a result of standing out in the pouring rain.
Even though science would prove that colds are not caused by cold weather.
Oh, those scientists, what do they know?
The environment that I mentioned before, you know, the current administration, do you feel like there's a risk of that being hampered, that movement towards science? Obviously, the EPA, budget cuts, all of those things.
It's awful. I feel so terrible for the 15,000 people at EPA who work like dogs for the nicest mission ever, protect public health and the environment. How bad can that be? And they've become the first swamp that the president needs to drain. You know, at least that's what he said. So I don't know. You've got a president that just believes in some outdated sound bites like you can't have a strong economy and a good environment. Apparently he's been missing in action for decades while we've been doing exactly that. You know, he's not really respectful of the science. It's the budget cuts that we see, the lack of investments. This is when you double down in research and science, not when you back off of it. And Massachusetts in particular is going to get hammered by a few billion dollars in losses if that budget should go through. Mm-hmm. And
you're referring to the
president's
thin budget,
proposed
which
budget. Yeah.
Isn't likely to go.
No, it isn't. But how much is likely to be restored? That's what you got to think about. No, it's not going to go unchallenged. Mm-hmm. But who's going to get those resources, and what are they going to fill in? You can't explain all that in one piece of paper, double spaced. You know, we need leadership that explains what they do and really looks at all of the implications of decisions they make rather than look at one side of the ledger. Mm-hmm. They've never talked about the benefits of regulation. They just want us to get rid of two regulations for every one we do. How arbitrary is that? Why isn't it 12 to 1? Why isn't it 1.5 to 1?
Well, I think they might agree.
No. They'd agree with the 12th one. I take that back. You know, but also they just really are subordinating science in favor of delivering on what is essentially politically expedient campaign rhetoric. They're not trying to expand their base. They're trying to deliver every single promise that he made from the podium while he was campaigning for how many years was that? It seemed like 12 and a half.
Well, of course, you would expect and hope an elected official is going to follow through on his campaign promises. But I'm curious about your thoughts on what people who do believe in this in science who want to make a difference. I mean, what now?
Well, there's a couple of things. I think, you know, part of the interesting thing is that I think this president, I agree, you don't want every campaign promise to not be fulfilled, but I've never met a candidate that I agreed with everything they did. People have to speak up about what they like and they don't like. And I've never met a president that didn't want to expand their base. This one doesn't seem to be interested in that. So we have to express the needs of the people. Right? That's what we do. And so people need to stand up and say, what are their core values? What do they want to invest in? And we saw with the Reagan administration that they tried to really kill EPA's budget, and people spoke, and it didn't happen when it got to the Hill. You know, people had to respond to their constituents. So you got to reach out to people. And in science in particular, we have two kinds of threats. The budget we talked about. The other is there's a couple of bills floating on the Hill that have been proposed on the House side that we think the Senate will be able to block, but I worry about them popping up in the budget somewhere. There are two of them. One is a bill that basically tells EPA that they cannot consider in their standard setting process any studies that have been done that can't be duplicated where all the raw data isn't available to everybody in the United States. Now, this would take off the table, you know, studies that are done by such tricky little people like Harvard University and the American Cancer Society. God forbid we give them any benefit of the doubt. These are some of the best science we have. They're cohort studies for decades. I cannot duplicate those. I cannot give out publicly protected private information. And they're basically taking those off the table because they would undermine our ability to be able to defend some rules that are very cost-effective by taking away the health benefits associated with lower particulate matter. This is an absolute attack on science, on those universities in institutions that are doing that science, and it's just trying to limit our ability to use the best science to make the decisions we need to make that are really essentially public health protections. Mm-hmm. The other one has to do with messing around with EPA's peer review process, which is really done in a very credible, transparent way. And they're basically saying that if anybody in a university or a nonprofit has received any money from EPA the prior 3 to 5 years, they're not eligible to sit on a peer review panel, even though they're experts in the science, and even if it has nothing to do with the money they received from EPA. As if we bought a scientist with a $5,000 grant, and we now own them no matter what we're talking about. And so they're no longer allowed to participate. Who's going to do the rinky-dink science that EPA, with a small budget, is going to be able to do? You're going to scare everybody away. So the small money that we give for large studies, like the 6-city studies at Harvard that I was really referring to earlier, mm-hmm. that they want to discredit, you know, we have an ability to tweak that a little with small amounts so we get more data that's more readily available to us for policy and for regulatory decisions. Well, that will no longer be available to us. The other thing they said is that if an industry person wants to sit on the same peer review, they can sit on there even if their industry is directly impacted by the issue that's under consideration. Now, how blatant is that about trying to stack the deck, not in favor of science, but in favor of special interests? Mm-hmm. You know, we got to pay attention to this stuff. You got to have your eyes open. And you got to just do what I think people are realizing they have to do now, which is to get involved. Because this is a heavy lift to roll back all of these rules. It doesn't happen with an executive order being done. But it will happen if people don't speak up and become active citizens again. So I am right now very hopeful, and I'm having a blast. I use that word on purpose. I could have said groovy, like we used to do in the 60s and 70s. You're going
Not
to marches.
You would know.
You're holding up really cool posters. I might have to break out my bell bottoms from how long ago. You know, it's fun to see people actively involved. You know, they have to be actively involved. And I think we've missed that for a generation. Mm. We've given government too much credit that is doing the will of the people. Now it's about time for people to say what their will is. And if I'm reading things correctly, there's still a lot of bipartisan interest in clean air and clean water and keeping our planet safe for the next generation.
Well, Gina McCarthy is a spring 2017 fellow at the Kennedy School's Institute of Politics. You can follow her on Twitter at Gina EPA. Gina, thanks so much for joining us.
It was great to be here, Matt. It was really nice for you to give me the time. I appreciate it.
And before we go, I'd like to offer a heartfelt congratulations to all the graduates of the Kennedy School's Class of 2017. In my job, I'm privileged to have an inside look at the great work many of you are already doing to improve lives around the world, and I just can't wait to see what comes next. HKS PolicyCast is a production of Harvard Kennedy School. I'm your host, Matt Cadwallader. Natalie Montaner is our guest wrangler, Sarah Abrams, our sage advisor, and Becky Wickle, our digital guru. Send us your comments and questions to policycast@hks.harvard.edu or on Twitter @policycast. And subscribe on iTunes and elsewhere by visiting hkspolicycast.org. See you next week.